This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. The hearing is on. Lawyers for Christine Blasey Ford have confirmed that she will appear before the Senate Judiciary Committee this Thursday. Ford has accused Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of sexually assaulting her when they were both in high school. There are still procedural and logistical issues to sort out, including whether senators or an outside attorney will question Ford. The latest we have heard from her lawyers is that the only witness to the alleged assault, named Mark Judge, has not been subpoenaed. Kavanaugh now faces more allegations. Another woman came forward accusing him of inappropriate sexual behavior during his years at Yale University. Now, this matter has become something of a litmus test for the country's view on harassment and where those views might be changing. Now, fair warning, this hour will probably include some very frank discussions of sexual assault, but we want you to speak freely about what this means to you and to share your questions about all this. So email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Joining us to discuss this is Jeffrey Rosen, the president of the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. He's also a law professor at the George Washington University here in Washington. Professor Rosen, welcome back to 1A.
Great to be back.
Here with us in studio is Fatima Goss Graves, the president of the National Women's Law Center. Fatima, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
And also with us in studio, Rebecca O'Connor is the vice president of public policy at RAIN, the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. Becca, glad to have you with us.
Thanks for having us.
Let's begin with just your gut reactions to the New Yorker piece that dropped just yesterday. A second woman has come forward with a misconduct accusation. Her name's Deborah Ramirez. She claims that Kavanaugh dropped his pants in a drunken college party and exposed his private parts to her right near her face. She says he also forced contact with her and then she pushed him away. Now, Jane Mayer and Ronan Farrow of The New Yorker co-reported this piece. Mayer spoke to Morning Edition about why her source took so long to come forward.
I think given the environment we're in right now, where there's just so much anger and so much on the line and so much partisan rancor, I think anybody would be quite reluctant to weigh into this unless they were very certain of what they wanted to say and what they remembered.
Jane Mayer speaking today on NPR's Morning Edition. You can hear that whole conversation at npr.org. Fatima Goss Graves, I want to work my way around the panel and just get everybody's gut reactions to kind of where we stand right now. Fatima, let me start with you.
My gut reaction is that she is bold to come forward after seeing the way that Dr. Blasey Ford has been treated over the last week. She's seen attacks on her credibility. She's seen the sort of calling her confused or mixed up, efforts to make her seem like she made it up. And she still came forward. And so my gut reaction is that they need to pause and take this and the other allegation extremely seriously.
Jeff Rosen, what do you think?
I think that it's going to be an extraordinary week, and this reinforces the wisdom of Anita Hill's op-ed in the New York Times on September 18th, where she said the Senate needs neutral procedures for investigating harassment allegations. Out of fairness, both for the accusers and for the nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, the fact that two decades after Anita Hill, we don't have a protocol about whether or not the FBI should be involved, who should do the questioning, whether witnesses should be subpoenaed, is really unfair to both parties. There was a remarkable conversation where Margaret Atwood, the author of The Handmaid's Tale, recently said, in the wake of Me Too, it's urgently important to have neutral adjudicators for all of these allegations out of fairness to all parties, and we're going to see that very powerfully this week.
Becca O'Connor, what about you?
I would say that this doesn't surprise a lot of people, hearing another allegation about this individual and seeing multiple allegations come out. And that speaks to the overall numbers that we know exist. Every 2 minutes an American experiences sexual assault. Ultimately, this, just like any other claim, needs to be investigated. It needs to be thoroughly investigated and looked into. And I echo what Fatima said, that this is something that should be applauded in terms of an individual willing to come forward, willing to share her story. Far too few victims feel comfortable and confident doing so, and that's what we're trying to change.
Another voice we should add for our panel for the hour joins us from Houston. Josh Blackman is a professor at the South Texas College of Law, where he specializes in the Supreme Court and constitutional law. Professor Blackman, glad to have you with us.
Thanks for having me back.
Same question to you. Your gut check in terms of where we stand right now, including with this latest allegation?
Well, I think we should take a step back and look at this in a bigger way. In a criminal court, the burden of proof is in the government to show that the person did it beyond a reasonable doubt. In a civil proceeding, in a civil court, the burden is on the plaintiff to show that more likely than not, they're going to win. But the Senate is in a criminal court, and it's not a civil court. It's not even a real court at all. And this is primarily a court of public opinion and popular opinion. So I think that the way the Senate handles this is largely disconnected with how this would happen in any real tribunal. And whether Dr. Ford and Judge Kavanaugh testify this week or not, ultimately this will be a credibility determination based on the senators and not the sort of thing that would take place in a regular court of law.
I do want to get more into the kind of evidentiary standard here in just a little bit. I'm glad you brought that up, and I do want to touch back on that again. I should also note, President Trump is at the United Nations this morning. He said, kind of between sessions there, he said, and I'm just quoting from him, "I am with Judge Kavanaugh. He's a fine man with an unblemished past, and these are highly unsubstantiated statements from people represented by lawyers. You should look into the lawyers doing the representation," unquote. That's part of what the president said this morning while making his way through the halls at the UN. Jeff Rosen, can we take a step back before we dive into all this? It almost seems like forever ago that the confirmation process for Judge Kavanaugh began. Remind us kind of what some of the big issues were before all of this came up and whether all of this, these issues, the ones before and the ones now, locked together at all, or whether this is just kind of a spreading series of controversies.
As in the Clarence Thomas hearings, the first part of the Kavanaugh hearings seem unconnected to the second part. Earlier, we talked about Judge Kavanaugh's judicial philosophy. There was strong disagreement between Democrats and Republicans about whether he was too pro-executive power, whether or not he would overturn Roe, and so forth. But despite the charges of Democrats that he'd been less than forthcoming in some of his testimony, I think it's fair to say that broadly it seemed, although very contentious, a nomination that was going to be confirmed. These allegations have completely changed the calculus. There's no longer a jurisprudential standard for evaluating it, as Josh Blackman said. It's a political one, and we know from Thomas Hill that it's extremely volatile. And the fact that there, 20 years later, is no Senate precedent for identifying this, it's not as if this is a surprise because it did happen before, really is going to make this all the more difficult to predict and navigate.
Fatima, there were questions about Kavanaugh being, to put it bluntly, good for women. Before he was ever accused of what Christine Blasey Ford accused him of, what were those concerns about, and what was your sense of them once they started to surface?
The National Women's Law Center opposed his nomination long before any of these allegations came forward, in part because of where we deeply feared he would be around access to abortion care and reproductive health care more broadly, in part because of a series of decisions that he had around worker protections, and in part because of opinions that he had on access to health care. Each of those things made us deeply concerned about what sort of judge he would be for issues that are core to women's lives. So when Dr. Blasey Ford's allegation came forward, we had already opposed him. And our first concern was that there was this woman who had been publicly outed. She didn't actually initially want to come forward. And we knew immediately from 1991 and the treatment that Anita Hill faced that she was going to get a heavy weight on her, that it would be the shaming and blaming and demonizing of her. So our first concern was that she be treated fairly and have a process that was impartial, that actually got to the facts.
We're speaking to Fatima Goss Graves, president of the National Women's Law Center, Professor Josh Blackman of the South Texas College of Law, Becca O'Connor, the VP of Public Policy at RAIN, the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, and Jeff Rosen, professor of law at the George Washington University and the president of the National Constitution Center. Thanks to those of you who've been sharing your stories with us. Stacy emailed, in 2005, my daughter was raped by her close friend's brother. She was 15 and he was 20. It was reported 3 days later to the state police. As of today, no charges were ever filed and he was never held accountable. Furthermore, my daughter continues to have mental health and emotional issues, which I attribute to this assault. I still don't know if we made the right decision by coming forward. Becca, I know we have to pause in a moment, but we've gotten a lot of emails from listeners sharing their recollections. And to those of you who shared them, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. I know that's hard to talk about. We really, really appreciate it. But Becca, before we have to pause, I imagine that Rain has been pretty busy in the week since these accusations came to light.
We absolutely have. And I echo again the courage and bravery that it takes to talk about these issues. But if we're ever going to move the needle, people need to reach out. They need to be able to share their stories. On a normal day over a weekend, we'll see about 730 users on our National Sexual Assault Hotline, which is available 24/7, 365 at 800-656-HOPE. And this weekend, we saw between Friday and Sunday a 57% increase in callers.
57%?
57%. So in 2017, we served more than 209,480 individuals through our victim services programs. We're on track, again, to topple that number as we approach 25 years of service. And we've added more than 50 staff so far, and we'll continue to do so as much as we can.
MJK tweeted, speaking as an adult woman who has dealt with unwanted sexual advances from grown men since I was 12 years old, this week has been gut-wrenching and horrifying. I'm certain that there is a better person for this job. That's what we'll discuss, what impact this would have on Brett Kavanaugh's fitness for the job, for serving on the Supreme Court, as we continue with Jeffrey Rosen, Fatima Goss-Graves, Josh Blackman, and Becca O'Connor, and with more of your questions as well. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We are discussing the accusations against Brett Kavanaugh with law professor Josh Blackman, Jeffrey Rosen of the National Constitution Center and the George Washington University, Fatima Goss-Graves of the National Women's Law Center, and Rebecca O'Connor of RAIN. We welcome your questions and thoughts about the hearings, the accusations, and what happens going forward. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A at WAMU.org. Carmela emailed, at least a dozen women I have been in contact with have stories to share about being sexually compromised by men. Examples include being smacked on the butt at work, being cornered in a hallway and touched, being kissed, being groped under clothing, felt up during swimming practice, and attempted rape. Not one woman reported these incidents to anyone. Cheryl tweeted, will Kavanaugh be expected to prove his innocence beyond a reasonable doubt, or is the accuser to present evidence of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt? Josh, I know that you chimed in on this a bit. Jeffrey, I'd like for you to do so as well. Professor Blackman's right. This isn't a court of law, but do we have any sense? There doesn't seem to be much precedent, as you kind of alluded to, as to what the evidentiary standard could be. So I'm not sure how we can know that, for lack of a better term, justice is being done with this process.
Well, I think, Josh, you raise a very fair point. Usually, in any sort of proceeding in court, there is evidence on one side and evidence on another. And there's a neutral fact finder, which is a jury or a judge, who is supposed to decide, does the evidence meet a certain burden? The person emailed about a reasonable doubt, right? If there's any doubt that this person might be innocent, if it's reasonable, the person doesn't get convicted and get sent to jail. If it's a civil proceeding, if it's more likely than not that this person did it, that's enough for a jury to award damages, for example. But here we're dealing with allegations from decades ago, and we don't have firsthand accounts other than the assailants and perhaps maybe one or two other people. It's possible to prosecute long-ago sexual crimes. Look at the Attorney General of Pennsylvania recently released his grand jury report about a number of members of the Catholic Church who decades ago engaged in awful acts of sexual violence. So it is possible to have these sorts of long-ago accusations developed. I don't know that there's enough evidence to meet the criminal standard, but I think what the centers will do is make a credibility judgment of who they think is perhaps more credible and whether those acts and accusations are enough to change a vote from Kavanaugh from yes to no. But there are no clear answers here on how this is supposed to be done. This is a senatorial function.
Yeah, we've gotten plenty of comments from several of you because there are no clear answers to this. Harmony tweeted, "I'm not surprised Kavanaugh did those things when he was young. Was it right? No. But should it keep him out of the Supreme Court of the United States? I don't think so. It was decades ago. People change." Mike emailed, "I am inclined to believe the two accusers. However, if everyone was judged currently on their actions in high school and college, particularly over 30 years old, likely a large percentage of us would not be continuing in our current jobs." Fatima, what do you think?
Well, it's interesting because I don't think anyone would suggest that a large percentage of men are actually engaging in the sexual misconduct as described by Dr. Blasey Ford or by Deborah Ramirez. Those are sort of extraordinary acts, which is why people are asking for a pause and that they be treated seriously. But I think another important point is, one, around the standard that should apply here. It isn't just what is the standard. I think a threshold question is, what is a fair inquiry that will actually allow us to know some of the facts? And here, they have set up a process that is designed to fail. They haven't allowed for an FBI investigation. They aren't allowing even the witnesses who have been identified as being involved. There's Mark Judge. There are a series of people who are now unnamed from Yale. There are other people who could be providing both the FBI and the Senate very detailed information. Instead, there's sort of this partisan process that isn't going to inspire deep confidence no matter the outcome of the vote.
Jeffrey, do we have any sense, you know, of what the process is supposed to entail in terms of what's supposed to matter with who gets confirmed to the United States Supreme Court? I mean, how much, I don't mean to, you know, drag up the Founding Fathers again, but how much did they intend for our nation's top jurists with lifetime, indissoluble, unimpeachable, irrevocable legal power to be chosen based purely on their jurisprudence as opposed to their character? Like, what was the goal originally? Do we know?
Well, we do know that the process was incredibly polarized and politicized from the beginning. The outgoing Federalists were so determined to deny the incoming Jeffersonian seats on the Supreme Court that they changed the size of the Supreme Court when Thomas Jefferson came in with the Judiciary Act. And then when the Jeffersonians got control, they repealed the act and changed the size of the Supreme Court again. So any notion of neutral nonpartisanship has never materialized. On the other hand, until the Bork nomination in 1987, there was a general consensus that you'd look at the character and qualifications of the nominee and not judicial philosophy. That totally changed with Bork. But then what changed with Clarence Thomas is the notion that personal misconduct is deeply relevant. And you ask for precedents. We really don't have a good precedent from the Thomas hearing because both sides, liberals and conservatives, believe that the processes there were not fair, even though the FBI investigated. And as you've just been discussing, everyone wants a fair procedure. It's also right that senators will be applying different standards. Some senators have said it's not a court of law, it's a credibility determination. Others have pledged that if the Democrats take the Senate and he is confirmed, that they're going to reopen the investigation and recall all the witnesses and relitigate the whole things. And some people are even threatening impeachment. So what's so staggering about this moment is that there are no precedents and no rules in what is essentially a test of credibility in the highest political stakes imaginable, and we need those fair procedures.
Yeah, last week, Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse from Rhode Island told Jake Tapper on CNN that as soon as Democrats get the gavel, that they want, if Judge Kavanaugh, even if he got confirmed to the Supreme Court, they would want to reopen this again and keep investigating. And Professor Blackman, I wonder if that gets to, you know, some of the other challenges of the details of how this goes forward. Mark Jensen tweeted, "I would love to hear your guests discuss the difference that appears to exist between what Democrats and Republicans seem to think comprises a fair hearing. Disallowing a subpoena of possible witnesses to testify to what they may or may not have observed hardly seems fair." And Bob emailed, "Since Judge Kavanaugh insists that he is being wrongly accused, can someone please explain why he isn't insisting on an FBI investigation to clear his name? Professor Blackman, I wonder if Kavanaugh himself, just because of the nature of this process, is kind of stuck in a tough place. He's released these little statements, but often when you go up for confirmation for something, you're just supposed to speak at the hearing and then let whatever politics play out and not interject in the middle, right?
There was an FBI investigation. So we all saw the confirmation hearing play out in Capitol Hill a couple weeks ago. What we didn't see is that after the public hearing closed, there was a closed-door session. And at that time, the FBI briefed the senators, there were no cameras there, on any possible issues. So there was an FBI investigation. Senator Feinstein had this letter, and she cited confidentiality as the reason why it wasn't discussed. It could have been discussed, this confidential hearing, and it wasn't. Should there be an FBI investigation going forward? I really don't have many major objection to it, but I don't think it will resolve anything. Because even if the FBI comes out and says that we don't have enough evidence to, you know, make a credibility determination, it will still fall to the senators to either believe Dr. Ford or Judge Kavanaugh. You know, it might delay the process a bit. I don't know. But I think at this juncture, people have more or less drawn their lines, and they've said, I believe this, I believe that side. And, you know, an investigation might settle some minds, but I don't think it'll settle any votes.
Yeah, quite a few of you have commented in terms of the politics of this and exactly what you just said, Josh. Michael emailed, news sources have been predicting a second allegation for a week based upon a comment from Senator Feinstein. So this will play as yet another political maneuver by Democrats to delay until they can retake the Senate. The biggest problem with all of this is no matter what the outcome, huge swaths of the country will feel like an injustice has been committed. Speaking of that outcome, senators on both sides of the aisle have been discussing their predictions about not only how Thursday's hearing will go, but how the confirmation might go. Here is part of what Republican Senator Lindsey Graham said on Fox News Sunday.
She will be treated respectfully, but she will be challenged, just like Judge Kavanaugh. When I voted for Sotomayor and Kagan, I wasn't just a white male Republican. I was some kind of really smart, wonderful person. I know what the game is here. I am no different now than I was then. I may ask questions if I feel the need to, but I think it'd be smart to have a professional litigator do this. Give Ms. Ford, Dr. Ford, a chance to be heard. Give Judge Kavanaugh a chance to be heard. Compare what she says with everything else in the record, and I'll make a decision.
That was Republican Senator Lindsey Graham speaking on Fox News Sunday. Contrast that with what Democratic Senator Patty Murray said yesterday on Meet the Press.
The way the Senate Republicans have now set this up, that is what we're going to have, is do you believe her or do you believe him? That is exactly why we have been pressing for an FBI investigation that should only take a few days, so there are other facts out there, that there are other witnesses. In fact, I have said many times that the Anita Hill hearing was a disaster, but they did have an FBI investigation. They did have other witnesses. There were other ways to judge this. The Senate Republicans have predetermined the outcome of that this will be a he says, she says, by taking that away.
That's Democratic Senator Patty Murray speaking on Meet the Press. Fatima, is this fated, based on the structure of it, to just be a he said, she said?
What's extraordinary to me is that she's still coming to the hearing this Thursday, despite having members of the committee commit that whatever she says, they're still going to vote for Judge Kavanaugh. She came forward because she said she had a civic duty, but it highlights what's totally wrong with this process. There isn't any sort of neutral inquiry that you can look at to make determinations of. My hope for this week is that whatever happens, there is a different sort of teach-in moment around sexual violence. In 1991, survivors learned the exact wrong lesson about what happens to you when you come forward. There is a new opportunity to show in the era of Me Too that when you come forward, there is a chance to be believed. There's a chance to be treated fairly.
91, of course, referring to the Anita Hill hearings, the Anita Hill testimony during Clarence Thomas's confirmation.
That's right. 25 years after Anita Hill testified, we have finally gotten to the point where survivors feel like they can come forward and name their experience again. We'll all be watching to see what happens this week and whether naming your experience comes only at the detriment to you and nothing positive comes from it.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. John tweeted, "Why not talk about Ford's friends that say it never happened? I don't know Kavanaugh or Ford personally, nor do those plastering themselves with 'I believe Ford' pins. Those who do agree on one thing. They recall no such party. Accuser doesn't equal victim." Karen tweeted, "Does any of this make a difference? McConnell has already said Kavanaugh will be confirmed," referring to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. "Seems like it's a typical old white male reaction of patting us little ladies on the head and saying, they're there." Becca, what do you think?
I think that we need to step back and realize that what happens in this situation, you know, what happens in that hearing room should this move forward, will have a mark not only on the individuals present, but on countless others across the nation that are watching. We have a situation where 7 out of 10 people are not reporting to law enforcement when these crimes occur. And let's be very clear, these are not little things that you can swipe under the rug as, well, boys will be boys, or this happens. These are felonies in many instances. And what we say, and I'm not speaking only to this case, but what we try to remind people is that this is a crime that the FBI ranks just under murder in seriousness. And we need to treat it as seriously as it impacts those who are victimized. And so ultimately, you know, we can talk about the whether or not this is a hearing room and a court of law and what it will mean to this one individual to be heard, which is critically important. But I also want to point out that for the millions of people watching, the survivors that are still deciding whether or not to share their story, 1/3 of individuals or 1 out of every 3 that come to our hotline say they're telling somebody for the very first time. That's a really powerful and important trajectory that we need to keep moving forward if we're ever going to take these criminals, who are serial criminals in many instances, off our streets.
How common is it, Becca, for someone to wait decades or at least years to go by before speaking out?
It's more common than people understand, and in fact, that's why we see states across the nation reevaluating their statutes of limitations laws. We're supporting that to allow more time. There's you know, evidence and studies that demonstrate that trauma, which is what occurs in these instances, has a very strong impact on an individual on their ability to remember, on their ability to heal, and there is no perfect timeline for healing or coming forward. This is something that we have to allow people the space in the room to come to terms with, and also to grapple with the very personal decisions that are involved here, whether it be fear of retaliation once they name the crime, and also fear that they will not be believed, and that, unfortunately, is a persistent challenge.
Matthew emailed, "Wouldn't it be great if every high school and college boy believed that if he tried to rape a girl, it would have consequences for the rest of his life?" Deborah emailed, "The question of Kavanaugh is not one of how everyone is judged, but how someone with a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court should be judged. This is not about Kavanaugh himself, but about our ongoing trust in the law." Jeffrey, I wonder if you can answer this question from Virginia. I think I know the answer, but I'd like to hear it from you. Virginia emailed, "Can a Supreme Court justice be removed if crimes are proven after he is appointed?" I think the answer is no, Jeffrey, but I don't know that there's precedent for that.
The answer is yes, he could be impeached. Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, one Supreme Court justice was impeached. Justice Samuel Chase, who sat on the Marshall Court, was impeached for his obnoxious and oppressive opinions. He was a Federalist who denounced Democrats from the bench. And Chief Justice John Marshall testified for him, and he was acquitted by the Senate. And that precedent came to stand for the idea you can't impeach someone because you disagree with them, because they're obnoxious or disliked. However, many federal judges have been impeached for committing crimes, and I don't have the exact numbers, but a decent number have been removed from office. So if 2/3 of the Senate and a majority of the House decided after a Supreme Court justice were confirmed that he had committed crimes, they could indeed convict and remove him.
Before we pause, Josh, do you think that lays up a more credible threat to Judge Kavanaugh if he becomes Justice Kavanaugh?
What they would nail Kavanaugh on is not the sexual assault allegations themselves, but the testimony. That is whether he committed perjury or not. And perjury, as we know with the Mueller thing, could be a very flexible standard. And I do suspect there might be some movement to try to impeach him if he's confirmed based on perjury.
I Am a Warrior tweets, I don't get the White House insistence on Kavanaugh. He wasn't on the original list in 2016. Others on the list would get past the process, just like Neil Gorsuch did. Why is Kavanaugh such a line in the sand? Good question. We'll get some answers to that and more of your questions in a moment. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with Jeffrey Rosen, Fatima Goss-Graves, Josh Blackman, and Becca O'Connor. This is, of course, the big story throughout the week, and we would love to continue to get your questions and thoughts about this as this story develops, particularly any aspects of it that you think are not getting the attention that it might deserve, or for that matter, if you're still undecided about this. What are you looking for? What questions do you need answered about Brett Kavanaugh or Christine Blasey Ford or Deborah Ramirez or any of the players to help you make up your mind as to not so much whether or not he did it, but whether or not he is qualified to serve as an Associate Justice of the United States. Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. You can also use our app, 1A Vox Pop, to send us a radio quality audio file and to keep up to date on future topics. But we will continue discussing this through the week here on 1A on your NPR member station, and you can get the latest online at npr.org. I would also like to repeat that number that Becca mentioned earlier for the National Sexual Assault Hotline. It's a confidential resource. You can call it anytime. Here's the number, 800-656-HOPE. That's 800-656-4673. And to that point, Becca, before we get back to talking about Brett Kavanaugh, Ellen tweeted, I would like to know what we can do as a nation to encourage better reporting by victims of sexual assaults. I know few who went public immediately after being attacked.
Great question. First and foremost, you know, continue to be supportive when someone comes forward. We know for a fact that the response that someone gets immediately after sharing their story will have a marked impact on their ability and willingness to come forward and share their story. A lot of tremendous things are happening, much of it with federal support and state reforms to ensure, for instance, that law enforcement officers and other investigators and prosecutors are equipped with the tools and information, including about the neurobiology of trauma and how to do things in a trauma-informed and victim-centered way that are changing the system so that more victims will feel comfortable and confident coming forward. But at the end of the day, we're seeing, you know, we're supporting 22,000 people on average a month through the hotline, which, thank you for repeating, is also available online. Some folks prefer a chat format, and we make that available as well. And also, if you have a story that you believe, you know, by amplifying it will help others, we do have a speakers bureau, and we welcome your voices as well in this chorus of awareness building and education. And ultimately, if you haven't educated yourselves on the facts of sexual violence, and I'm not pointing fingers at folks, I've had really interesting conversations with close family friends and folks I thought understood these issues in depth over the weekend. There's no shame in honing up and learning everything you can about these crimes and their short and long-term impact.
Fatima, there are also some challenges, I think, depending on the circumstances. I mean, I work for American University, which owns WAMU, which produces 1A. And when there are matters of sexual assault on campus, say if it involved a student, I'm not faculty, I'm staff, but if it involved a student, there's also Title IX to deal with. So it seems like part of the challenge might be, depending on where you are and where you work, there are other factors at play that can make for this tough, like a matrix of decisions of what do I say and do I say, oh, you should definitely report, or, well, if you tell me, I might have to tell someone else. Like, all of these other things are under it, too.
Well, our laws, both Title IX, which bans sex discrimination in education, but also Title VII, which bans sex discrimination in employment, have long meant that institutions like schools, like workplaces, have to address harassment and violence when it occurs. And part of that means you need to have a place where people can report. And when they report, they need to be treated fairly. And so many of the things that you're seeing happen in both the public court of opinion, but also with the Senate, would be totally unacceptable if they happened from us coming from a school or coming from a workplace, the sort of bullying tactics that you saw over the last few days where they were saying you need to commit to these strange conditions in the next few hours or we're taking a vote. All of those things you can imagine if you were an employer or if you were a school, if that is how you treated someone who was coming forward, they would take it as a desire not to hear from them at all. It would send a strong message not only to them, but also to anyone else who might want to come forward in the future, and you'd be on it, your face in violation of those key laws.
Dan wrote on our Facebook page, if the Republicans allow the Democrats to do this, we will never have due process in this country again, and no one will want to go through the nomination process. If lies and or 40-year-old indiscretions are allowed to be presented at the last minute, we all have failed. Josh Blackman, what about that, the matter of the timing of all of this? I believe I recall Senator Dianne Feinstein saying she knew about it for a while, but didn't want to go public until Christine Blasey Ford was willing to be named, so it was not just some unnamed accusation out of the ether.
I believe the date from Dr. Ford was dated in July. The FBI has a process where they can investigate allegations in private, where they're not made public. So Senator Feinstein could have handed this over to the other committee members and the Senate, as well as the FBI, to investigate it, and she didn't. So I think there was a process of failure there. But I'm still sympathetic to the claims being made. When you're being confirmed to the highest court in the land, you should be held to a higher standard. And teenage misbehavior, I think even below the age of 18, can bear on that. If you've lived a perfect life since then, it might be mitigating, but I think all things ought to be considered. If anyone in your area in D.C. has gone through a background check, they don't ask, you know, just what have you done the last couple of years? They ask, what have you done your entire life?
Right.
And people can be denied security clearances, not based on convictions or judgments of courts, but mere allegations that might be enough when you hold a position of public trust. So I do think when you're going for a position like the Supreme Court, that kind of stuff matters. But there is a process built into the confirmation aspect where the FBI can investigate stuff in private, but now everything's blown up. And by the way, Rod Rosenstein apparently is resigning, so today's about to get a lot more interesting.
We're working on getting some double confirmation on that, but as soon as we get that a little bit stronger confirmed, that's all right. We just want to make sure that we've got that pegged down before we attribute that. And I do want Fatima to chime in on this, but to the point you just made, Josh, I want to get Carolyn's email. Carolyn writes, far too many experts talking about this hearing as a trial, citing constitutional rights. Kavanaugh's hearing is a job interview for a job to which no one is entitled and for which some are not qualified. The Senate needs to start listening and investigating evidence for a possible hiring, not an acquittal. Fatima?
Her point was spot on, but I wanted to get back to Senator Feinstein not turning over the information. Dr. Blasey Ford asked for confidentiality. And that is a fundamental piece here. Survivors who already report at really low rates will not report at higher rates if they know that they do not control any part of the process, including whether or not they become a public figure. And many of the reasons she didn't report have unfortunately for her come true. She's had to leave her home. Her life has been threatened. She has been publicly demonized in the media and elsewhere. So it is asking a lot for people to want to come forward. She was initially outed and then finally told her story. Just one more point. The issue around whether it matters if it happened when you were young, I think is a really core one, because I don't think anyone is saying no matter what you do when you're 17, you can't be on the Supreme Court. And even if you engage in gross misconduct, I can imagine a situation where someone is able to demonstrate, I am deeply sorry for what I did then, and here is how I've changed. That's not at all the situation where we have here. Here, Judge Kavanaugh hasn't said, I'm deeply sorry from steps I took when I was young. He has said, it wasn't me. I didn't do it.
Before we get to the next question, I should note one point. You may have noticed that I and other hosts on NPR tend not to refer to the accuser as Dr. Ford, but just as Christine Blasey Ford or Ford on second reference. No disrespect, there is a reason for that. NPR News tends to only refer to someone as Dr. So-and-so if they are medical doctors, if they're an MD or a DO. Christine Blasey Ford has a doctorate, but she's not a physician, and so that's why we've been making that reference. So just to kind of keep it neutral, we refer to Brett Kavanaugh as Kavanaugh on second reference, and Christine Blasey Ford is Ford on second reference. We are not intending any disrespect. It's just the way that our news standards are structured. There's also been a question, Becca, about the fairness of this and the motivations that Ford has for speaking up in the way she did. Matt emailed, "So your panel contends that a person would never knowingly mislead others in a situation where partisans have said a nominee will strip women of their rights? Ford has much to gain with her allegations. Anita Hill is doing just fine."
Wow.
And I think he's referring to the fact that today Anita Hill is a professor at Brandeis University.
Sure. No one wakes up in the morning expecting to be sexually assaulted. And no one, I can say that with 20 plus years of experience, decides that they want to be the poster child for this issue and put themselves out there. To say that the impact of coming forward has been beneficial for anyone is just disingenuous. It's just, it's troubling to think that that could be a sentiment at this stage in the game where we really have evolved as a society to recognize the impacts of these crimes, not only on the individuals, but on our overall society and on their families and children and what have you. You know, while this process is political, sexual violence is not. It impacts almost every family in America right now, and that's something we can't just pretend isn't the truth. It may be inconvenient in terms of some political desires for individuals, but at the end of the day, what this is about for us and for many people watching is how we as a country listen to survivors when they do take the brave step and come forward, and in all fairness, hear out both sides and do it in a way that is impartial and true to the forum in which we're having these conversations.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Margaret tweets, "Please ask your guests why won't the president end this controversy and pull Kavanaugh's nomination? Trump had at least two other very conservative justices he considered. Why not end this sideshow?" And I Am a Warrior tweeted, "I don't get the White House insistence on Kavanaugh. He wasn't on the original list in 2016. Others on the list would get past the process, just like Neil Gorsuch did. Why is Kavanaugh such a line in the sand?" Professor Blackman, what do you make of that? Why do you think that Judge Kavanaugh's name has not been pulled?
Well, first off, we have to keep in mind Judge Gorsuch replaced Justice Scalia, which didn't really shift the balance of the court. In contrast, Judge Kavanaugh will be replacing Justice Kennedy, the fulcrum, the swing vote on the court. So I think the stakes are much higher. Now, why is Kavanaugh's name not being pulled? I think it will be a resounding defeat for Republicans, who will see that their president can't even get their own guy confirmed with the Senate majority. There's always a lot of frustration among conservatives that they can't get stuff done. So I think this will be a huge blow if they were to yank Kavanaugh's nomination. But there's still time. Even if for whatever reason Kavanaugh does withdraw, they can probably still get someone confirmed before the January session ends. Now, it becomes very difficult if Republicans lose the Senate and they confirm Kavanaugh during a lame duck. I think that would up the ante even more from wherever we are with Garland and Gorsuch.
Let's talk a little bit more about what might happen in the future, Jeffrey. Now, on Sunday, yesterday, Congressman Jerry Nadler of New York, Democratic congressman, tweeted, quote, "Any credible investigation against Kavanaugh must include testimony from Mark Judge. If the Senate Judiciary refuses to do so, the House Judiciary Committee certainly should," unquote. That tweet set off a backlash, including among some Republicans. Here is what Republican Senator Susan Collins said about that on Friday.
"I was appalled by the president's tweet. We know that allegations of sexual assault are one of the most unreported crimes that exist. So I thought that the president's tweet was completely inappropriate and wrong."
Senator Susan Collins of Maine, Republican senator, responding on Friday, I believe, to the tweet from President Trump asking a number of things, including why Ms. Ford didn't come forward sooner. Jeffrey, tell us who Mark Judge is and whether he could be a turning point in all this.
Mark Judge is the classmate of Brett Kavanaugh, whom Dr. Ford alleges was at the alleged assault. And she says that he jumped on top of her, and as a result, she escaped. Now, Mark Judge has denied the account. He says he has no recollection of it, and it didn't happen. And he's also said that he has nothing further to say. Republicans have decided not to call him. He has written a lot of controversial stuff about assault over the years, and they may be concerned about his credibility. Dr. Ford has insisted that he be called because she says he's the only corroborating witness. But Representative Nadler's statement is really significant because, once again, if Democrats take the House, they will have full subpoena power. And Nadler would be head of the House Judiciary Committee and could well subpoena Judge and any other witnesses who were not called during this proceeding to lay the grounds for a potential Supreme Court impeachment. So all that suggests that whatever decisions are made this week may not go away and could be revisited in the coming session.
Hey, Becca, one last question we should end with. It's another aspect of this whole matter that's come up several times. Lori M. tweeted, several people have said that Brett Kavanaugh was a very heavy drinker in high school and college. How can he be so certain that he never did what's been described? Both women, so far, said that drinking was involved in their assaults. Before we go, a number of these allegations have involved the drunken incidents. How much should alcohol or the presence of alcohol in these incidents factor into the way that we deal with them, with the kind of credibility that we put in?
So intoxication is something that has literally been taken up by state legislatures in terms of these issues to try to clarify that the intoxicated state of an individual can impact their ability to consent under legal terms. And that ultimately, here's the bottom line, it is not excusable to claim that an incident occurred while intoxicated, whether you are the perpetrator or you're blaming a victim. And our state database breaks down state's laws on that if anybody would like to see it.
Before we go, just now at the top of the hour, we can now confirm what Josh Blackman mentioned early on. We have received multiple reports that state that the Deputy Attorney General of the United States, Rod Rosenstein, has offered his resignation, and the White House has accepted it. You may remember that the New York Times reported that Rosenstein spoke about invoking the 25th Amendment to unseat the President of the United States, and apparently his resignation has been accepted. This will definitely have ripple effects on a number of programs and initiatives going on through the Justice Department, not the least of which, the big investigation he was overseeing, the Russia investigation. We'll have more on that on your NPR news station and online at npr.org. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.